Is the classic car market in decline? Are prices correcting? Is now the best time to buy, or is it a good time to sell? We're going to assess 2023 in the third quarter in this all-encompassing roundup, just so you have the inside track.
Buying or selling a classic car? Head to historics.co.uk or click below for a free valuation.
Hello and welcome to Historics Vidcast here at the Historics HQ. Now, before we get started, please remember to like and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Without these subscriptions, we of course can't produce these lovely videos. So even if you hate us and want to hurl abuse, like, subscribe, and then write it afterwards. Now, today I've gone with the big guns. Since we're talking about values, I've gone with market specialist and editor of the Haggerty Price Guide, John Mayhead. And of course, our very own Stuart Banks, who's had more time in the car industry than I have years on this planet. Sorry, Stuart, that dates you somewhat.
Thank you.
Now, let's go straight on to our main topic, third quarter into this year, and the market has been indifferent, and lots of our viewers, our customers, your clients have probably all been asking, what's in store, what's happened, where are we with classic car values? Let's start with you, John. What have you seen? You've got a vast amount of data that, that you can trawl through at any given time. Where do you feel current prices are?
Do you know what? I don't think it's that bad. I think there's been loads of really bad press over the summer. And I think that if you're just watching auction results and you're looking at sell-through rates and you're looking at what prices are retained versus what they were in as reserve, then you're going to go, it's all bad. But there's lots of context behind that, and that's really thin. You know, Haggerty has, as you say, tons of data to look at from all around the world.
Yep.
And what we're seeing, it's a lot more subtle than that. There's a difference between what buyers' expectations are to sellers' expectations.
Definitely.
I think that's a really big part of it. And I think there has been corrections in certain places, but I don't see that as a bad thing, really. I think that that's quite healthy for the market in general.
We've said for years and years and years, the internet is a great tool, but it's also a bit of a pain in the backside sometimes, because obviously a lot of people will look at for sale prices and expectations will grow.
Yeah.
And we've always said before, you know, part of our job is to disappoint people on values of their cars when we go and see them. We joke, but limiting the expectations and understanding the value of their car is the toughest part of the gig, really, isn't it?
It is.
And I think correction is possibly the right word for it. There is a slight price correction, and it always takes a bit of time for sellers especially to sort of engage with the fact that their car isn't worth £20,000 if it's worth £18,000. And it's all well and good pushing for that, but you've got to work the system. You've got to work the buyers. Stuart, what have you noticed in auctions?
We've had a good sales rate throughout the course of the year, really. And one of my favourite sayings, as you know, is good cars make good money.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'll ever change me from that point of view. If a car is prepared correctly, got good provenance and priced correctly, it will sell, and it will sell well. And they are the basic fundamentals of actually what we deal with. Mm. So if a car's quite average, if it's a bit edgy, and people expect too much, that's where you see a slowdown in the marketplace. Buyers are being a little bit more select and a little bit more choosy, but they've got every option and every right to be. And as John says, I think with all the data that is available, we've seen a softening in the marketplace, but not to any great extent, not to a disastrous extent in any way, shape or form.
There's certainly, we use the word, there's certainly no fire sale, is it? It is just a
correction. No, not at all. I think that we talk to all sorts of different people in the market, and Haggerty, you know, likes to go out there, because we don't just track data. We want to get Haggerty eyes on and see what's going on. And we want to be at auctions, and we want to be with dealers and talking to them. And one of the big things which comes across, and the word keeps coming back, is confidence. And you know, I specialize in classic car data and values. And if you ask me where the market's going to be in a year's time, or where interest rates are going to be, or what wars are going on in the world, or where, you know, it's such a complicated situation at the moment, and everybody's just going, oh, I'm going to be a bit more careful. And I think that's what it is. It isn't a fire sale. It's just people being a bit more careful.
I've used the same line time and time again when people say, where is it going to be in a year's time? I said, if I could predict that, I wouldn't be doing this job for a living. I'd be on a yacht with a collection that I just filter out bit by bit. It would be the case. We don't know the lottery numbers to that. Ultimately, you look at the marketplace, where it's been. You look at extenuating circumstances, which it always have much like the property market, I suppose, that it always has an effect on these classic cars, because if confidence is shrunk in other areas, then naturally that will seep through. And what we had for the last decade was this huge upswell of investment talk.
Yeah.
And how classic cars are better than gold to invest in. And, you know, and we always joked about, well, that's great, but you don't need to service your bar of gold, do you?
Yeah.
But that confidence from interest rates, from government, will always have a wobbling effect. Because if you were then suddenly confident, you might go and buy that car. But if you're not confident, you might just hold back a little bit. And I think a lot of that is, when you're then selling your car, you've got to think of that, and you've got to understand that your job is to get that buyer confident in the car that you're presenting and selling, so as to manifest those bits.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you're quite right, both of you, in that if a car's particularly special and particularly good or rare, ultimately the market's almost irrelevant, because if there's only one of these cars and you're all fighting over them, then it is the essence of auction. But if there are 10 similar results or cars online, your trick is, and we've said this a lot recently, getting people off their backside to come and have a look at yours.
Well, it's a tricky situation, because you've got, as you say, you know, those really special cars are making really special money, and we're still doing it, still getting records. And then you've got all those other ones where if somebody's got a collection and they've got one car which maybe isn't, you know, isn't as good as the other ones, and they may be thinking, okay, I'm coming under a bit of pressure here and I don't really know what's going to go on, so I'll probably sell that one.
Yes.
But then all the buyers are looking and going, well, that's not very special, so I'm not going to buy that one. I'm going to sit on my hands. And so then everything kind of, you know, slows down a lot. And but the really good thing, as far as we're concerned, is we talk to everybody. And you look at all the restoration houses, you look at all the events, and they're mad.
Absolutely.
They're all sold out, and everybody's investing. So all those other ones, you know, all those ones that they think, I'm going to sit on those, I'm going to keep those, they're putting money into them. So there's no lack of money in the world.
I think people still want to be with classic cars. And I actually think that, you know, the new washing machines of Teslas and things that actually help that, because there is that want to have an evocative, you know, combustion engine. It'll become much more of an enthusiast market with a bit more hobbyist. And as you say, all of the events that we've been to have all been massively attended. The scrambles are abysmal.
Oh, yeah.
They can't get tickets quick enough.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a market there. And perhaps what might be a grand thing with this slight correction is that actually it'll bring a lot of these cars just into that more enthusiast sphere where people can afford the cars that perhaps a year ago, 2 years ago, they just couldn't get to. And they're buying for what I think is the nicest way to purchase a classic, because you really wanted it, because you always remembered it. There is always a place for investments in classic cars. Of course there is. We're never going to deter that, because if you've got something that's going to sit in a collection, it's going to be worth, you know, or double its money. F40's been on, you know, tip of everyone's tongues recently. But ultimately, there's chaps with TR5s, with, you know, with nice RS2000s, they've been priced out and suddenly might be priced back in. Minis are a good example. I don't like to put one particular car, but Minis, Mark 1 Mini Cooper S's, were up at 55,000 pounds. Well, there's no enthusiast paying that unless you've done very well.
Yeah.
Dropping back down to 35, and suddenly the car they always wanted could be the car in their garage.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think the other thing you have to remember as well is we are in a fluid marketplace. The market, if you look at when I came to Historics over 12 years ago, the late 40s, 50s cars were selling well.
Yeah.
But actually, everything moves on 10, 15 years, and now they're a little bit more difficult to sell. But the 80s and 90s cars, they're absolutely on fire.
I know we're going to move on to that. It's the it's really interesting. As an insurance company, we don't just know what the car's worth, we know how old the person is who buys it. We know what they buy next, what they had before. And so we can look into that sort of thing. And it's really interesting. So for the first time ever this year, baby boomers, so those born before 1965, have been overtaken by Gen X, so born 65 to 1980, as our most... that's our biggest generation of clients worldwide. And 60-odd% are born since 1965, which was always out of it. So that generation, the boomer generation, which was, you know, was really into those cars, because those had that massive, you know, that gave them the passion from where they got the passion from. Yep. So the XKs and the E-types and the,
this,
you know,
from the era
DB5
cars were something special. All cars were something special. That, you know, now we're talking about cars being almost, you know, planned obsolescence like phones, but back then.
But it's moved special. On. You know, I'm Gen X. My heroes are 930 and Testa Rossa and Countach and, you know, that's
and
that's
it also
where the money's
brings
going.
Into that same thing with confidence in the market is that actually there are buyers out there. We've not seen a lack of people to buy,
no,
but we haven't seen them in as greater numbers. Mm. So perhaps where there were five people for that car, there's now three. So similarly, drop that back into the 50s cars and you've gone from three to what, and then it becomes tougher because less people there.
That's the
not only due to the market, but because it, as you say, it's fluid, it moves forward in eras, and we have to adjust at all times. So and positives are obviously that it is more affordable for enthusiasts to come back in, and bear in mind, these markets are cyclical.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you buy now, you couldn't say if it's the lowest. Again, we can't predict that it's going to get any lower or higher.
Yeah.
But if you buy now and when you're thinking it could then return in 3-4 years to sort of really a bit more. We could talk about buying a car for £20,000 that's worth £25,000 in 5 years' time. There's always an uptake with anything that's sort of slightly depressed because you think at some point it may well come back around again.
I think if you're buying a car for an investment, you're usually onto a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, we always say, everybody asks me, what should I buy? So buy what you love.
Yes. Yeah.
Because if you love it, somebody else will love it.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing is you've got people who reach a certain point in life, they've got a certain amount of money, and they think, I'm going to buy that car I've always wanted. And some of those are a little bit hesitant at the moment. And maybe it's because they don't mind spending the money, but they don't want to lose their shirt. So they don't want in 6 months' time to go, it's worth 20 grand less. And so they're kind of hesitant. But again, maybe that, you know, I think that will stabilize. And I think this summer it's been a tricky time, and I think that's really good because that probably stabilizes the market. So come next year, I think people will be much more realistic, especially sellers, and then I think everybody will be going, yeah, I'm happy with that because that price has been less.
I mean, bringing it into
volatile.
Sort of into those extenuating circumstances. You know, we're at a point where the current government are sitting on their hands somewhat. For a very good reason. We've got a general election in, 18 months or so.
Yeah.
Now, they're not going to stimulate until that's going to be fresh in the memory. So we're at a point where everything's just stale. Now, everything's just sitting on their hands and just keeping it quiet, keeping the powder dry. At some point, pre-election, that's going to change. They're going to just stimulate like you wouldn't believe so that in fresh in everyone's memory is, the Conservative government have made everything fantastic. It's how politics works.
Yeah.
Politics has an effect on the economy. The economy then could have effect on values of cars. That said, there's no guarantees in that. And I sat there and thought, well, it could. I thought prices, I don't think prices are going to change. I think this correction, which is what I'd like to call it, it's probably got 2 years of running itself at this level. My hope is it will stay at this level and won't go shoot up or down. There's no rush. I think it's just pick the right car.
Yeah.
And your thing I picked up from earlier, you said going to see in cars is key in when we value this. Same with yourself. We can all look at, let's say an Aston Martin V8, you can all look online and say, there's 6 Aston Martin V8s, look where they've sold.
Yeah.
There's very little that you can really pull from an advert or from a photograph that gives you a real sense of what that car was like. And when we work at auctions, the one thing that drives us nuts, really, because in the last 5-6 years, especially since the pandemic, people have been much more, you know, much more engaged with their digital devices and thinking that, you know, I can understand all this from afar. Trust me, it's better to attend, to go and have a look. And you don't have to buy something because you're going there.
Yeah.
Take it as a day out, as a trip. If you go to 3 or 4 different auction houses over the summer and then you purchase something in the winter, well, all you've done is proper research, enjoyed it, because they are quite enjoyable,
they
most of these places.
Fun, yeah.
I mean, often the coffees can get a bit expensive, but they are enjoyable. You might struggle to drag the other half along, but they are good to go to. But if you go and see what these cars are like, then you'll get a better grasp of value, because people that come to us with an assumption of value and then they're relating it to a car that I know was, let's say, far better, far worse. Again, it's not, as you say, not apples for apples, is it?
It's not, but you touched on a good point there. We have seen in the last, I'd say, 5-6 auctions, we've seen a lot of fresh bidders. People come to the auction, new faces we've not seen before, they've registered to bid, but not purchased. Mm. And I think these people are falling into that category. They're just doing a bit of homework.
Yeah.
They just need to see the right car on the right day, and that's it. They'll be there.
Mm. Confidence will return.
And it's that falling in love. And I've done that, yeah. Where you go to see a car, be it at an auction or a dealer or somewhere like, or a private seller, and you know, it's almost unexpectedly, you go, oh, I love that, absolutely yeah. love it. And yeah. then you, that's when you go, yeah,
it starts,
I'm going to actually
it?
Do that.
It's a bit like
yeah.
if you ever go on auto trade, you think, uh-oh, there'll be a new yeah. car in 3 months' yeah. time, because yeah. I'll start, I won't be able to stop looking. Yeah. It's a bit like my wife on Rightmove. I forbid her, I delete the app. Yeah. I go on, delete the app, yeah. stop looking. Because it just starts to sort of trend in your head, and before you know it, you've thought about what you're going to do with upgrades or restoration, and then suddenly that's it. You're there putting your hand up. But you must attend these things. It's the only way to get a real grasp of value. To look online, I mean, we have to say data points or everything, but you can only really take that as a mean average.
Yeah.
And as we quite rightly said, a lot of these cars are outliers, and those outliers are the ones that, if they're in fantastic condition, they may well be worth double. Equally, if they are really ropey, they may well be worth an awful lot less.
Yeah.
So you want to be making sure that your valuations for what you're purchasing are based on a little bit more experience, and then taking this data that we can provide you as a bit of an idea of where you should be spending your money.
Completely. I mean, there's something I get all the time. So the Haggerty Price guy's got four values based on condition, but it's for a car.
Yeah.
It's not for the car.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, well, mine's worth a lot more. Yes, it is, but you know, yours might have extraordinary provenance. It might be one of the bookend cars. It might be one of the very first or the very last. It might be, you know, might have something extraordinary about it. Yeah. When we come to insure a car, we'll insure the car.
Yes.
So we will, it will be a different value. It is a guide.
And this is where what we do really does intersect, because it's the same with us.
Hmm.
You can tell someone what a car may be worth, but until we go and see that car, we can't tell you what that particular car is worth.
Yeah.
And it's the same situation. We can all say 90% of E-type Series 2s are worth this amount of money. Relatively easy to pin an area.
Yeah.
But when you go and see that car, you could be dragging it back 10%, 20%. You could be pushing it forward 10%, 20%.
Well, how many of those have been left-hand drive converted, right? How many of those have been restored properly? How many of those have got, you know, when you actually get close to it.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of thing where it's really tricky, you know, to work a median value out.
It's quite right.
It is. You've got to work it out more cleverly than that.
With auctions in mind,
you've just chosen there. I know where there's a one owner E-Type Series 2, done less than 5,000 miles. So how do you value that if you're just looking at a piece of paper and picking it?
Well, that brings on to a lot of cars now, which we've said before and on this podcast actually about mileage being almost an obsession with more modern cars. We'll cover it a little bit later, because it does set cars apart, because we make more cars now. When we talk about later era cars, we make more cars. Therefore, you know, there's not 300 of one car, there's, you know, 300,000 of one car. So how do you start boiling that down? And Ferrari have been very clever at making sure the special models and special models to keep values at a high point. Yeah. But mileage has become, you know, quite a high factor in people purchasing, but not a great factor in a car that will run very well for you. So that's investor versus collector, isn't it?
No, it's something I hate. Mm. I mean, it's...
don't worry, we've said exactly the same. Low mileage cars end up being in glass boxes.
Well, they're not a car.
No.
You know, the car's going to move.
They're just artwork, really, aren't they? They're collected artwork.
Absolutely. And it's not even artwork, because it will continue to fall apart if you don't do something with it. And, it's really hard. And all the cars that... I'm also a concourse judge, and there was a very good article in a magazine this month about a car that was at a show over the summer, which I saw, and I felt exactly the same about it. And it had been restored, I won't say what it was, but it was restored by its manufacturer to an extraordinary standard. I mean, to the extent that every single, you know, wire twist was absolutely perfect, and all the bolts were lined up, and it was just immaculate. And this was a racing car from the 1960s that has been battered.
Yeah.
And I've seen it go off at Zandvoort and properly bend itself and all these sort of things. And it showed
none of that. And you want the scrapes, the slides.
Like, where's the history to it? Yeah. And you want that, you know, it's a passion game, this.
You take away the character of the car when you do that, when you over-restore it.
Absolutely.
So on that note, then, have you got any low-mileage cars for the next auction, Stu? next auction, of course, we'll go briefly over it, because obviously we're at Mercedes-Benz World on the 25th of November.
Yep.
Anything in the pipeline, Stu? Anything that... that you think would be a good buy, that you think that really will buck that trend?
I'm chasing, as you know, we've had plenty of discussions about it.
Yes.
Quite a special Ferrari at the moment. If that comes in, that would be a lovely car for us to sell. And it is actually a perfect auction car. It is a perfect auction car. How do I see the market going, and what do I think that auction will do for us? I think the expensive cars, Mercedes-Benz, well, we always tend to do very well at Mercedes-Benz.
Yes, actually, nine out of the last 10 years, that's been our most successful sale of the year, which people can't get their head around because it's November.
Yeah.
But actually, it's always been a very successful sale.
It's always been a great sale for us. Mm. Yeah, and for me personally, but it has always been a great sale for us. So, but we've got some special Bentleys coming in, a couple of lovely E-types, and at the moment we have quite a healthy collection of Land Rovers coming in the auction. So
I don't know, that may have been, they've been incredibly popular over the last 3-4 years. Again, loads of them bought and sold over COVID, lots of later 90s and resto modded and upgraded cars.
Are they older ones or are they defenders?
The older ones, defenders really.
Interesting. So defenders, so we also track shipping data. Okay. And still the most the most numerous classic car imported into the States is the Defender.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
Even all the JDM cars, and they're all coming out after 25 years, and it isn't. It's the Defender.
You really surprised me.
And most of them come from here.
Yeah, you
they
really
just want big
me.
Engine Defenders.
That's one for the marketing team. If you can get a lot of Defender stuff into the States, please.
Yeah.
Any North American spec stuff just flies. I mean, it's extraordinary.
It's funny because we've always struggled. Well, for over a decade now, it's this strange thing. If we've pulled loads of cars out of the States, loads of E-types, and yet nothing seems to ever go back. Even the really amazing American cars, we struggle to engage. There's a few of our customers that have sort of understood that it's just shipping it over. It's relatively simple.
Yeah.
It's long as it's a classic. But it's a funny market. They don't tend to look outward as much as, I think at a higher level they possibly do, but as much as, you know, even Australasia, Malaysia, we sell a lot of cars around the world, but the States is one place they very, very rarely look over.
It is interesting. I think that one of the things that we're going to go and talk about 90s cars, and we've looked at the price guide over the last year, and the make that has made most money in a percentage terms is Subaru. In the guide, and that all comes down to one car, which is the Impreza, and that comes down to a number of really big sales, but also you look at it across the board, and it's mostly UK sales. Like 6 of the top 10 Subaru sales across the board have all been in the UK, but they're 25 years old now, and you think, well, they surely must be going to the States. Some of those, and you think, well. We haven't seen them yet, but
well, hopefully I've got a P1. I've been. Dancing around that's been family owned since almost new and fully restored. Restored, so nice. I'm trying to get that in for the next auction, so keep an eye on the website for that one. So on to our second topic, we've alluded to it a couple of times. It's the 90s revolution, as I've called it, because as we say, things move along, but the 90s appears to be really on song at the moment. Lots of people, not just the top end, because obviously there are, you know, McLaren F1s and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
that
kind of skews the figures.
It does a little bit. But all sorts. I mean, I know, for instance, you own a BMW 8 series from the 90s.
And love
I absolutely love those. There's Skylines. Yeah. Clio Williams, they've shot through the roof again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the only thing I have a concern about the 90s is because having lived through it and owned cars through it, will they last?
You know, it's interesting because you could easily say that about 80s cars or 70s cars or 60s cars. And a lot of those have just been restored to more better standard than they were originally. My car came up and I've got a 944 outside and it's 88, but, you know, the S2s are fantastic cars. And the build quality on those things is extraordinary and they're not worth a lot of money yet.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to push those, by the way. That wasn't that kind of fun.
You can ask Stuart to consign it later.
They're just... And interestingly, as an insurer, we're now talking about, because more modern cars equals generally more power. And so traditionally, we've gone, oh, well, therefore you can go faster, so you're
going to crash.
So it's going to cost more. But actually, when you look at 90s cars, you've starting to get crumple zones and airbags, and, yes. and you've got effective seat belts, and you've got, you know,
and parts were made in greater numbers,
and
which
parts were made in greater numbers, and there was safety, there was more safety, yeah. and so actually, in terms of, you know, what's important about those cars is, and they're really drivable. You know, it might yes. be really hard for somebody to drive a 60s car if they're not used to it, or a 50s.
Yeah,
or a
I can't daily commute a 1950s car, but yeah. I can daily commute a 1990s car, which is
that's why
difference.
I'm driving that today. I've driven up from Chichester, which is quite a trek, you know, a couple yeah. of hours. I've got an MGTC from 1946, which I absolutely love to yeah. bits, but
you wouldn't have taken
I'm not
it.
Driving
it
up Gen 25. No.
With a woolly hat on.
Exactly.
But the one thing that worries, because I looked through some of the data and actually had looked through, I think it was one of the other marketing people, that they said the big problem we have in the 90s, though, is a lot of cars were in effect starting of the scrap. They were scrap cars. Cool. So yeah. there's a lot of cars that are falling off the edge a little bit before they get to the point of restoration. Now, of course, that's not the special cars. Mm. But some of the really old, cooler cars, I think, that sort of their numbers yeah. are dwindled when you start looking at how many left. I know that's not an exact measurement. Mm. But a lot of these 90s cars have really struggled to be yeah. kept on the road because yeah. the values have been nothing, and because yeah. scrapping became a thing. You could scrap a car and get a deposit for something new. That was obviously government funded. So, you know, things like, I mean, I had a penchant for a GT4 Celica. I can't believe me find one
no.
at all. I mean, most of them probably were wrapped around trees anyways, but can't find one of those. Fiat Coupe Turbos, I loved those when I was yeah, a kid. Yeah. Can't yeah. find any of those. Yeah. The ones I can find are absolutely useless. The S8, the big Audi S8.
Oh, great car.
Which I think is great. I mean, only because of that one movie, let's be honest.
You could live in that car.
Yeah, a great so, car. But yeah. there's less of them, which yeah. might well be a really good trend for not necessarily the high-end stuff, the GTIRs and the McLarens, but that underlying car enthusiast level where there yeah. is a great deal of these about because most of them are thrown away.
Yeah.
Nice examples are going to be quite sought after.
Oh, definitely.
Especially with the electrics. You know, if you've got a ratty old car, it's going to take a lot of pulling it back together again. I mean, you're 840. What's the wiring loom like that on that?
Can't tell you. I cannot tell you how much money I've spent on that car over the years, honestly. So, but if you look at the 80s and the 90s, it was a real transitional period for the motor industry. In the 60s, 70s cars, they were built out of poor metal. They would rust. Manufacturers started to get to grips with the fact that their cars were rusted away, and now it's completely different today. And it was also the start of fuel injection and all the big technical things coming on the car, ABS brakes, more things to go wrong, and often they did on the 80s and 90s cars. But everything has now been engineered to the extreme, and that's why cars today are very reliable.
I remember that the 90s S-Class was possibly the sort of pinnacle of S-Class, because at that point there were so many incredible design, maybe electrics, features that were put onto that S-Class that would have been light years ahead of, you know, the standard smaller car. They've almost caught up a little bit now with cars. I mean, they're trying to find innovations, and innovations are moving faster than the cars.
Yeah.
But back then, that S-Class had so much on it, which by comparison to an everyday Citroen Saxo was like chalk and cheese. You could still buy cars with wind-up windows in the 90s. There are not so many. Yeah. But, you know, an S-Class Mercedes, it was like a luxury Learjet at the time.
Yeah.
But it's a big era, and it's... I think the big thing is trying to find those really good cars and not just be tied down to mileage, as we say again.
Well, it's maintenance of through that sticky patch, because, you know, all those cars are going to go down and down. And
well,
then
I said the biggest example of that, not from the 90s, the Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow. Everyone wants a nice shadow now. Yeah. They don't exist. They do, but they're very difficult.
You're going to start from scratch.
Because they got down to sort of for nothing. You couldn't maintain a Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow properly, I say properly, in the Rolls-Royce fashion. And thus, trying to find one now in a good is impossible. And
it's all those cheap, you know, the old sort of cheap supercar thing. I had a Merak, and it was a beautiful, beautiful car, but it had been through that thing where it was worth $3,000 or $4,000, and you can't even take the cam covers off without taking the engine out.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's you know, to get that back on the road was like, oh my God, that was painful.
A good example of the 90s.
But it's a great car.
Is
when you get
the Maserati 3200, isn't it?
Oh,
same problem.
Same thing.
It's a Ferrari, basically.
Yeah.
but it's worth £7,000-8,000 at its worst now.
Well, find a good one. That's the point.
And then how do you maintain that car? If you've bought it at that price level, the problem is you probably aren't thinking of a £30,000-40,000 car. You're thinking about a £10,000 car. It doesn't really work.
Do you know the other thing is that I think we are in this transition period. So I've got a Porsche 912 and I've got a 944.
How many cars have you got?
I'm slightly obsessed. But they're all kind of like the slightly unloved ones that we used to be. And the 912, because it's a 911 base, I can buy absolutely everything from that at not a great deal of money, even direct from the from the dealer. I can ring up and say, right, I want this, you know, bolt, and they will go, yeah, I'll be in tomorrow. Whereas in the 944, because they're still not worth a great deal, they're not remaking.
No one's remaking.
They're not making all that stuff. Yeah. And I think that's where there's this sort of we, you know, now that there starts to be that interest and. Yeah. You know, 90s Mercs and BMWs.
1990s Merc, C60, C36, ECUs. If the ECU goes, there's no ECUs.
Until
an ownership, you need almost an owner's club to club together and say, right, we need to get someone in Japan to produce 500 of them.
Yeah.
And then we'll hold on to them and then spill them up. But there's not enough of those cars to dictate it. And they are wonderful cars, incredible cars. But same problem, you know, and Honda Integras were the same. Mm. Honda Integras, the parts, because they're rarer, they're really difficult to get hold of. They weren't making any numbers. There's no warehouse. So you end up having to lean on trying to find them through the owners club networks, hoping. My only prayer is
that
things
like... But
that's turning. Because of things like 3D printing and the ability to create things. I'm hoping that will change. It saves some of these 90s cars. Because if you can't get an ECU for something, and the ECU is £3,000 or £4,000, and the car's worth £6,000 or £7,000, we're talking insurance terms there, that's a write-off, you know. But it is in your own brain.
It is. Interestingly, we've had a lot more people put more money into cars recently than that car is worth, and we're looking at a different policy at the moment, which can cover that as a reconstitution policy. We're trying to work out the terms at the moment, but. That's a really good sign, because that shows, you know, it goes back to what we're saying, is if you're sticking with the car and you've got a bit of money and you go, well, instead of selling that and buying something else and I'm not sure about the other thing, I'll just put the money into this one, and that's
enjoy it.
That's
brilliant.
Yeah. You know, that's really good.
And it's also better for the planet. It's better than an electric car. If you just love your one car, improve it and work with it. Perhaps things like resto mods are probably starting to buck that trend as well. You're just sticking with one piece of metal, one block. It's actually far better than for the planet, and actually runs back into that enthusiast market, which we all love to deal with. Yeah. Genuine enthusiasts for cars.
Yeah.
So what would be your pick of 90s cars? And undercover, let's not go top end. That's a bit boring. We've all done F40s, McLaren F1s and all that faff. What would be your hidden gem? You're not allowed to say the 8 Series.
No.
Shall I come back to you?
I did my apprenticeship on Fords, and I've always had a big passion for Fords. And I've recently, you may not know this actually, I've recently bought myself a Mark II Cortina 1600E.
I didn't know that, no.
So, which does need restoring. You can restore them fantastically well through the owners' clubs. You can get virtually everything.
I know, Stuart, he won't.
So my big passion is Fords, really. I love a Capri.
See, that surprised me. I thought you'd go down the Jaguar route. Maybe too many years working with those.
I've had a lot of Jaguars over the years. Love them. They're great cars. But I'm coming back now. I'm at the age I am. I'm coming back to when I entered the motor industry, which is, as you said earlier, a long time ago.
Yeah. When did you start? Let's just quantify this.
I started my apprenticeship in 1974.
Just so you know, my date of birth is 1981.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, well done. Sorry, Stu. You've still got better hair than me, though.
But I have a great passion for Fords. I do. And my 1600E, I will restore to a great standard. But you know, years ago, this shows you how old I am, really. Years ago, I bought the Lotus Cortina Mark I for £100. Ran it for a couple of years, sold it to a friend of mine for £150, and thought I swam the channel.
Now we're
selling them at £50,000-60,000.
Well, we used to, that's the inevitability of it now. We all speak to people, and we've all got stories of that. How about yourself? Come under the radar, 90s car that you haven't already bought.
Okay, so I was going to say the early AMG Mercedes. I think they're just, you know, that first generation of AMG.
I just like that they are the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Oh, they're, I mean, you make your eyes hurt.
500E, the C36, you just don't know. Yeah. They look like taxis, but they go like supercars.
Yeah.
And I really do love those. And actually, I saw on the Haggerty channel, I think someone was, one of the guys over in the States was racing a 500E.
Yeah, did you see how fast it was?
It was unbelievable. Really impressive. I was thinking, wow.
Yeah, it was Jason Kamisa.
It was against an S4 event.
And an M5. And
yes,
it just...
No, it was an RS4 event. It was the Porsche developed car.
Yeah, yeah, right. It left them... I mean, it was like 70 yards ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
And if you asked everyone in a straw poll what would be the fastest car, I almost guarantee everyone would put the Mercedes last.
Yeah. And it was lowest power to weight ratio.
Probably the heaviest car as well.
Yeah.
So it was incredible.
Yeah.
So for me, difficult. See, I grew up with Alfa Romeos through the
90s. Oh, you see, and that was what I was going to say. I was going to say, Alfas.
Go on, which one?
I would go, it's got a bit Busso engine, so I was going to say, you know, that first generation, the GTV Cups.
You've stolen my thunder.
But then I remember, and it's a little bit later, but when the 147 GTA came out, and I got a test drive in that when it first came out, and it was just like, this is absolutely mad.
Still a guilty pleasure of mine, because you've put this huge engine in the front end of a car.
It's crazy.
And, I mean, it wasn't until the Q2 diffs came in, but it's an Alfa Romeo Trax, but it wasn't necessarily the best thing to do, but you just wanted that engine. And the flared arches, and when you sat in a 147 off the time, and then sat in a Golf or an Audi, you're like, you guys don't have to do interior design at all. The Alfa Romeo felt incredible.
Oh,
and I grew up with I bought GTVs on and off, so I'd do is I'd buy a GTV. It would cripple me. I'd buy a Fiat Cinquecento for a year.
Yeah.
I'd save the money. I'd buy another GTV. The people that bought GTVs off of me, get in contact if you know, because they were brilliant by the time you got them, but they had ruined me in between. And Alfa Aid in Maidenhead, I used to go to.
I know very well.
I used to go into Adrian and he would say, right, okay, this is what's fitted to your car. It's like treacle. It's rubbish. This is what we need to fit to your car, which should have been done from the factory. Thank you very much, Alfa Romeo.
Yeah.
And so this will cost you another £2,000. And so it went on and on and on. But I've had two GTV Cups. I don't know why I had two. I think I bought one, sold one. I thought I should have kept that. Bought another one. And it wasn't quite as good as the first one, annoyingly. The best car I had was an actual, it was a grey V6, which I had when I was working in newspapers years ago. And it just felt like a Ferrari. It sounded like a Ferrari. In fact, I fitted in it a stainless steel exhaust system with a release valve in it.
Yeah.
So that you had that nice burble, but you know, didn't take it away from the engine. Then when it released, it was fantastic. And they've crept up in value, in fairness.
They
were like the Fiat Coupes, and the Fiat Coupes are cheap as chips still now. But the Alfa Romeos, I think, because people understand what Alfa Romeos do for value.
Well, and there's a lot of people kind of doing all those mods to them.
Yeah, the Alfaholics team, for instance, we've got an Alfaholics Spider in the next sale,
which
is incredible. It's the Spider R, which they developed incredibly. But Alfaholics being a good example that sort of really strengthened that brand.
Yeah.
So that's that. It's strange. It overtook Maserati almost in values because people aren't really looking at the Maseratis anymore.
No, it's really interesting. But it's that, as you say, it's all those bits that were wrong on them have been fixed. There's a great mate of mine called Lawrence down at runs a place called Orsa Lusa down in Bournemouth. And I gave him money.
It's funny how they're great mates, these people.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Adrian, I consider a friend. It's probably because I've funded most of his life.
That was with a GT, with a 3.2 V6 GT, which I think again is just a fabulous car. And it's beautiful and they're worth nothing. And actually, if you get all those things done, you need the diff, you need a quaff or a Q2.
Yep.
You probably need to, you know, decant manifolds, but it's still not as an insurer, obviously.
The 147 though is still my guilty pleasure. I still wish I would use it every day, but the problem is it's almost too practical to have ever gone and got it, because it's like I'd use it. It's not quite a third sports car on the driveway. It's almost, I wish I'd have had it at the time and never quite got round to it in the end. And people went and bought R32 Golfs instead. I thought, it's just not the same.
It's not the same.
It's just too sensible, which is an odd thing to say about an R32 Golf, but it was just too sensible compared to the Alfa Romeos. Sorry, we've gone on a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay. I also like an Italian car, but it's not an Alfa Romeo, unfortunately. I love a Detta Messa Pantera.
I do, yeah.
Absolutely love them.
But they look fantastic,
They are just, they're like an American-Italian bastard child, though, aren't they? They're cheating a little bit with that big V8. But
they are cheating a bit, but I just love the cars.
Yeah. I must admit, the bang for buck on something like that is pretty impressive. And the noise and the train, it's amazing. The only other things I remember from the 90s is obviously all of the Japanese cars, which 300ZX I always quite liked, which was a bit left of centre. And we always said the Supra, which everyone went mad for because of the movies, of course. The Supra was probably the lesser of the cars available, but that was where everyone went mad. And those values, and talking about across to the States, that's suddenly obviously really kicking off because of their timeline on classics.
Yeah.
And that's really popular there. But that's
it's really interesting as well how people move. You know, because if something goes up massively, then they move on to the next gen or the next gen.
I can't have that one.
And it's, it's that, you know, it's happened with the Japanese cars, haven't we? You know, 90s Porsches. There's a reason none of us have mentioned 90s Porsches because they're all gone.
Yeah, it feels silly, doesn't it? It's like, well, it's just out of, it's just so expensive. Yeah.
And now everybody's looking at, well, 996s are the.
Yeah. We're not allowed to talk about 996s here because I bore people to death about the fact that the 996 Turbo should be the car to buy and yet still has not moved. In fact, I think it's come backwards on me.
It's the headlamps, you know, and it's the
only. So I'm doing it
just
again.
Just go 997.
Just doing it again.
Go 997, yeah, sweet point.
But it's not the first.
I know, but.
Or the only with weird headlights.
Yeah.
It's the first, you know, first water cooled Porsche. Weird headlights.
I get that.
I know you can't get a Carrera because you're worried about the ball scope. These are cars made like Fiestas, so it's a silly argument. Yeah. But then, no, I've gone bang that drop, and I'm just clearly. No one obviously believes me. Mm. Maybe in 10, 15 years' time, I'll sit there and go, should have done it. Should have stopped telling people and just done it myself.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, what we've done this time round, we're not going to go to a quiz, mainly because I just kept winning. Cheating, maybe.
Yeah, but so, as you wrote the quiz, you had the answers. So
what we're going to do is, Vicky had a bit of fun with us last time talking about the 20 pence piece for the tyre and gauging whether you need to replace them as we were talking about. So we're talking about little hacks for cars. Now, obviously, nothing too serious or sort of taking with John's hat on here. We don't want to talk about something that would end up becoming an insurance issue. Yeah. But little hacks that you might have had that have got you through. And I sort of went online last night. I thought, I knew a couple. What else is out there? There is loads of little hacks for cars now. So if we have a couple each, what have you got up your sleeve? Give me a good hack for cars.
I've got two.
And enthusiasts.
One would be, I've got dogs.
Yep.
Okay. So if you get dog hair, you can use this at home. You can use this on your sofa if you want to. To get rid of dog hair from the cloth seats of a car, so get a balloon, blow the balloon up, let it deflate, and then wipe the seat, and the dog hair comes off the balloon.
Wow. Did not know that.
No, did not know that. I've also seen someone do this online, again, because you see the weirdest of things when you type in these things. They took the end of a toilet brush, a new toilet brush off, snapped it, put it in the end of a drill bit, tightened it up, and then turned on the drill bit and used the toilet brush, which wrapped all of the hairs off of the chair.
That's quite a good idea.
And I thought of that in a classic sphere, because you know Triumph Stags with that weird leatherette they have, and they always get dusty, and you can not clean them. Probably work for that, I think.
Yeah. So,
and the other one?
Okay. The other one comes back to my mechanicking days, whereby if ever you drop a nut, a bolt, a washer, it always ends up in a place where you can't get to. Always. That's a fact of life. I think they call it Sod's Law, but that's a fact of life.
And then just leave it there and think that thing's been rattling around in my engine for the next 3 years.
And then inevitably you can't reach it. So, in my probably first 6 months of my apprenticeship, I learned how to magnetise a screwdriver.
Okay. So rather than going and buying something rather expensive,
you can go buy something, you can do it yourself. So you get a screwdriver, you get a piece of cable, just run it round the screwdriver. Here's one I prepared earlier. Okay. And I actually magnetised this screwdriver early this morning. So you get a piece of cable like this, hold it on a battery. Now, I wouldn't do this on a Mercedes SLR, but it's okay on an MGB and things. Ideally, the battery needs to be disconnected. So hold one end onto one terminal and just flash this end onto the other terminal 8, 9, 10 times, and lo and behold, you have magnetic screwdriver.
And how long does that stay magnetized for?
Probably about 10 years.
No, wow. 10
yeah.
years?
Yeah. So, and that's great for when you've dropped that little washer that you can't get to, just do that.
Now, question, you've got quite a bit of metalwork in your back. If I flash you across a battery, do you become magnetized?
Probably.
Do not try that at home. That's impressive. I said, I went through loads, and there's lots of little things like tennis ball in the garage, of course.
Oh, so that was going to be one of mine. Yeah. Oh, you've stolen one of mine.
I go to so many houses and there's a tennis ball.
That's a great
and
one.
Unless you knew, so what you do is obviously you've got a small garage and you don't want to prump your car, and rather than putting loads of carpet rolled up at the end, you hang a tennis ball at the exact point that it touches the windscreen, and that tells you you've got to stop. It's ingeniously simple, really, isn't it?
It's,
and I must admit, I've seen that so many times. Yeah. So I haven't stolen your thunder. Have you got any more?
Oh, you just nicked that one. I suppose one of the things that I've always found, and I don't know, I think most people know this, is that cleaning windows is always a pain in the backside of the car to get them actually clean and not smearing.
In the inside especially, it drives me mad.
And a little bit of damp newspaper. Old school newspaper, your free ads sort of thing.
Yep.
Wipe it in and then just turn it around and use the dry bit and then do that, and they are immaculate, absolutely immaculate.
Why is that?
No idea. It's just the stuff
in
the
science.
The stuff in the paper.
Okay, in the comments below, please, can someone tell us the science behind that? Why does that work?
I tell you what, it works better than any spray, anything, microfibers, you know, all this stuff. Piece of newspaper works.
Wow.
Well, I thought that was quite common. Oh, yeah. I'm happy about that.
I didn't know that.
Have you seen the toothpaste on the glass lens of the lights?
Yeah, that works well.
It does.
How long does it last?
It doesn't work as well as a. But in fairness, if you've got a really milky, I think if it's really milky, you need to get the old professionals out to really rub them down. But I've done it a few times on sort of cars that aren't too bad, and amazingly it works. But it works in the same way if you've got a scuff in a car park. Mm. That sort of scuff that's there, but it's not quite a dent. You can use the same thing with toothpaste there. I think it's because it's quite abrasive. And we used to have, when we were younger, there was always like something you would have almost like grit in it, and you'd almost be able to polish things out. I think it works in a very similar way.
Yeah.
I wouldn't leave it on overnight because I don't know what toothpaste does. It might be like, might be sticking things in Coca-Cola and disappearing. The other thing about windows, I read a couple of things actually, that if you mix paraffin and white spirit together, and wipe on the outside of the windscreen, it does the same job as those really expensive products to repel rain.
Oh, okay.
And the same, strangely enough, with fabric softener and dishwasher fluid. So both of those must have some form of compound in them that's similar to those very expensive things you can buy from Halfords or what have you. And it just repels the rain, so you don't have quite as much. You do always get really expensive stuff at car washes. Do you want us to put this on your windscreen? You're not sure what it is, and he charges you £7-8 for it.
Yeah.
Well, it could just be a bit of paraffin and white spirit. Or dishwasher fluid.
The trouble is, if I get the softener and I'm walking out the house in the morning, my wife says to me, "Where are you going?"
I'm doing
the washing. Just going to clean the windows on the car. She's going to look at me like I've lost it. So, but I will try it.
Well, why not?
We'll try it.
I was talking to someone. It's Ed behind the camera here. He didn't know this because I thought it was really common knowledge. But there is a lot of people that don't understand that there is an arrow on your fuel.
That's a great one. I nearly picked that one.
You've got a daughter and a son, and no one seems to get it. But if you don't know this, and you'll all think that everybody knows this, there is plenty of people that will not admit to it. They'll sit there and go, "I didn't know that. Now I do."
Yeah.
On your fuel gauge, next to the fuel pump, there will be an arrow right or left to tell you which side the fuel flare is, which is a great idea also when you're jumping into a hire car. So you don't get really stupid. Though it doesn't tell you how to open the darn things, because often that's a bit of a minefield.
Yeah.
But that's a simple, simple one that we should all know we don't. Any more?
So the only other one is again, going back to my side of... I always like taking cars apart. I'm not very good at putting them back together again. So what I try and do is, especially if it's something tricky, like, and I'm thinking about the back of a dashboard. You know, when you... There's that moment where you've unscrewed it and you pull it forward and you go, ooh.
Yeah, that's normally proceed with me the... Ooh.
Yeah, and she's like, ooh. And I just take photographs from every angle, and it doesn't matter how good your wiring diagrams are, they're never as good as a photograph of something that used to work.
It's a bit like when
then you can get it go back again.
It's always a bit like that IKEA furniture in step 7
doesn't
make any sense, and you keep going, is it me? Why does step 7 not tell me what we're doing?
Oh, I did this the other day, so with my 912, and it's got, and I went all the way through, and it's like, that doesn't make any sense, and then I realised that mine's got 5 dials, and it had 3 on the the wiring diagram's like, oh, that's why it doesn't work. It's the wrong car.
The other ones I found, oddly, on the door opening, you can open a bottle. I'm not sure that's particularly good use, because unless you've got an old bottle of Coke, you shouldn't really be opening a bottle with it. And cupcake holders in cup holders.
That's a good one. That's
which
a good one.
It seems to be the most prevalent one, because obviously there's always gunk in it. I mean, actually, most
doesn't that not stick in the bottom of your cup?
Well, and they come out of the cup holder.
Yeah, and then it falls out and all the.
That seems to be like really prevalent. And do I have one more? I'm sure I did have one. Oh, yes. And I spoke to you about this. So if you've got this sort of inherently foggy windscreen, especially when 90s cars were terrible for this because they never cleared correctly. You know those little silicone things you get in packaging?
That's also a good one.
Yeah, pop them underneath the windscreen and it takes some of the moisture away. I cannot understand how sometimes you'll be driving along even a motorway and you look left and there's someone, they could barely see out of their windscreen. I mean, how have you got this far? Yeah. And they're wiping it with their hand and it looks like they've...
Yeah.
And you think, oh my word, someone needs to go and help them with their settings just to get it done. But then Mark is just as bad as this. You get in his car and everything's just on full. It's a 2021 Range Rover. You can just auto everything. You don't need to touch it, but he's just...
Yeah, but he will have the heater on full at the front and air conditioner on full at the back just to balance it out.
He's a buffoon, isn't he? Honestly, he just likes to press the buttons. He doesn't like the idea of getting in it, doing it for him. I've got to press a button.
Yeah.
Maybe I've paid for that button. I want to press it. So there's a few hacks. There are probably many, many more. And actually, again, write in, let us know, because I was amazed at some of them this morning.
There's lots of them.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
Yeah.
Clean the tyres. Put the WD-40 instead of black tyre black. Put the WD-40.
Don't know what's more expensive.
So
WD-40 is one of those things you use for everything, don't you?
Everyone's got WD-40 in the house, haven't they? Everyone.
Right. Well, let's wrap this up. Thank you very much, both. Now, remember, if you do enjoy this, please go and check the YouTube channel for Historics. We've obviously got lots of videos, podcasts, videos of cars. Every single car is videoed for the auction. There's plenty to see on there. And again, like and subscribe so we can continue doing this. If you want to look at the valuations that John does, go to the Haggerty website. Now, we're going to look, try and integrate some of those into our website so you can actually understand our estimates and those values, so you get an idea.
There's two websites, I just want to point out.
What? You tell us.
Because we're a massive American company, so there's Haggerty.com, which is the big beast over in the States. So you can go on there, and they have a thing where you need to sign in to be able to do it. The UK, Haggerty.co.uk, has a valuation tool. You don't have to sign in. So you can just go in and look at the values. And the American one's been going twice as long as us. So it has got more cars. It generally tends to be a lot more American cars than ours. We still have about 50,000 values in ours, so it's not small.
It's a good data point.
But if you've got something slightly odd, go and have a look at the American one, and you know, if you want to put your put your email address.
It gives you a good idea, doesn't it? So we can use that later on, and we can get an idea for values of cars we've consigned as well. So.
Gives you a quote on the page as well. Yes. So if you're looking up your value, it will tell you what an indicative quote for that car is, so you can insure it for this amount.
Fantastic. Okay. Right. Okay, so remember also on the website chat, go to historics.co.uk to see all of the cars that have been consigned for the Mercedes-Benz World Sale on the 25th of November. By the time this releases to you, most of them will be there. With a bit of luck, some of these lovely cars that we've been chasing and talking about. But if you can, please come and visit us at that auction. So we, as I say, on the 25th of November at Mercedes-Benz World at Brooklands. We are open Wednesday, Thursday and Friday from 9 to 5 for viewing, and then Saturday auction itself. If you can't make it, of course, it will be live on YouTube and on our website. Now, if you have missed out on consigning and you haven't contacted us soon, don't worry, make the phone call. In the bottom notes here will be a link to our valuation request form, and one of our chaps will come back to you and talk about valuations. Perhaps we can look at the Haggerty tool and help you through any process with buying or selling. If you want to follow us on socials, now obviously I am at Matthew Priddy. We are at Historics Auctions. How about Haggerty socials?
Yeah, if you just Google other search things are available. just Haggerty UK, and you'll find us on all the social channels.
Lovely. And Stuart, you are?
At Stuart Banks, Stewart.
He has to be different, doesn't he? Well, that's all from us. Thank you very much, chaps. That was very enjoyable and very informative. We'll see you all soon. Thank you.